Okay. Well, this is an interview with Chris Hartmeyer on this series on who was Cesar Chavez. So, Chris, I'm very glad to be able to have the opportunity to finally talk to you a little bit. We've talked to a number of people who knew Cesar Chavez and for a long time, and probably none of them knew him as well and as long as you have. So, could you just give us an idea of how is it that you guys met each other, and how did that occur?
Well, in September of 1961, my family and I came to Southern California, where I became the director of the California Migrant Ministry, which was a long-standing ecumenical ministry to migrant farm workers. And I was told by my predecessor, I was given a long list of church people who I should meet as soon as I could. And at the top of the list was Fred Ross and Cesar Chavez, above all the church people. So they had been, they'd been expecting to hear from me because my predecessor, Doug Still, had told them I was coming. And we met and had lunch in a cafe in East Los Angeles, probably October of 1961. And then they were both involved with CSO, the Community Service Organization, and Cesar invited me to come to board meetings and conventions, which I did, and I just became really, really interested in the work of the CSO, and was present at the convention in Calexico when Cesar decided to resign and go off to organize farm workers.
Okay. Now, originally, when you met Cesar with Fred Ross, what was your impression of him? Did you think that this guy could?
I had no impression. Right. I had been told by Doug that these were, great organizers among Latino communities in Arizona and California, all over California, and that these were people I should get to know, and it was a very, cordial, I was young, I was like 29, and I probably looked 20, and so I was trying to tell them who I was, and they were filling me in on what the CSO and what it had been doing, and the relationship that had already been established with the California Migrant Ministry, and it was just like kind of get to know you session, and giving them an opportunity to invite me to participate in CSO meetings, and then I guess Cesar probably organized kind of like a training period for me. I spent six weeks in Stockton at the CSO, with the CSO, where Dolores Huerta and Gil Padilla were the organizers. So I don't have an impression.
Right.
I don't have a useful impression.
Okay. Well, what drew you to at that time to the work that Cesar was doing at CSO, and then what kept you going when you got involved with NFWA and all that?
Well, let's see. I went to board meetings. I got to know other people in CSO, many farm workers, poor farm workers from the Central Valley and other valleys of California were delegates to these meetings, and then the convention in Calexico was just like a fascinating split between the rural chapters and the urban chapters, because Cesar was pushing for CSO to take on farm labor organizing,
right?
Which the rural chapters were all in favor of, and the urban chapters had sort of like complicated questions about it.
Right.
And he lost the vote, but
right. And then at that point he decided to leave CSO, and
I was traveling all over the state all the time, because I had Micah Ministry had staff in, you know, in Santa Clara and Stockton and Fresno and in Visalia, Corcoran, Bakersfield, the Imperial Valley. So I was traveling all the time, and one of my regular stops when I was in the San Joaquin Valley was in Delano to, you know, to see if Caesar was around. And by that time, you know, we had recruited Jim Drake to be a staff person of the Migrant Ministry, and his initial training period was just to be with Caesar. So through Jim, I knew a little bit more about what was going on than most people did. But then I would see Caesar from time to time. He came to our, he came to a couple of our staff retreats, and one of them, Helen and Caesar came. And I'm sure in his mind, you know, he saw potential supporters.
Right.
But we were all fascinated with what he was doing, and wanted to know how it was going, and it, you know, it looked kind of up and down and not too promising, and but pretty much everybody in the Migrant Ministry by that time had had some time with Caesar and Fred, and were committed to what he was doing, were convinced that the people we cared about in the fields, that nothing was going to change for them until they were organized in some way. And Caesar was doing that, and we believed in it, and we got to know him better, and we got to see how smart and focused and strategic he was. And so we were all kind of like prepared for the day when the strike came in 65.
Right. So you say you were prepared for the for when the strike came in 65, but did you have any real idea of how tough it was going to be? Tell me about that.
We were prepared to be supportive. Fortunately, we had no clue as to what was going to, you know, come from it, what was going to happen within the church, and what was going to happen to our work, and how we were going to be, you know, slowly but surely drawn into supporting the strike and the boycott. So yeah, we had no clue, but we were prepared in the sense that we were prepared. We believed in what he was doing. We believed in his leadership, and so we were prepared to be supportive. And I've often said to people, I was the one who, you know, had to worry about the budget and whether we could support the staff that we had. And so when Caesar asked us to support the strike in Delano, I imagine I thought about it some, but even if I had said, no, I don't think we should do that, I think our staff would have done it anyway.
So what?
But I didn't do that.
What was it that kept everybody going and so committed, even against these huge, huge odds? Yeah.
Well, he was part of it. I mean, Caesar was not just smart. He was also personable, and he knew how to tell stories and draw people in and then listen, and he was just good with people, whether they be farm workers or us, and he was smart about what he was doing because of, you know, 10 years of experience with the CSO and with Fred's, you know, advice and counsel from time to time. You know, you could see the method, but you could also see the huge difficulties. So what kept us going? Well, it was, first of all, our connection to farm workers, you know, the personal connection, particularly by my staff, the personal connection people had with men, women, and their families who are out there struggling and working and suffering, and our belief that something had to change for them, and then this hope that Caesar could find a way to do it.
Right.
And so those were the two things that kept us going.
Right.
Now, after people, you know, started, after people went out on strike and then went out on the boycott, it was like, you could see the change in people's spirits and lives as they stood up against the growers, and as they took steps, you know, to do this battle, and then as they made incredible sacrifices to do it.
What
sacrifices
did you see, though?
That were always, always challenging to us.
And so what did you see around you? What did you see these, when people were faced with these challenges, these sacrifices?
Say that again,
Ray? How did you see that the people reacted to these challenges and when they were, you know, when they had to make these huge sacrifices? Were people scared, or did they get excited, or what did you see?
The workers?
Yes.
I didn't get to see the discussions that must have gone on, you know, in workers' homes when they chose to go on strike.
Right.
And somebody at home was probably arguing, you know, like, where is this going to go? I mean, what's going to come from this? You're going to get fired. You may get blacklisted. Who is this guy? You know, like, we've seen labor leaders before. They come, they go. What's so special about this guy that we should get this involved and take all these risks? So I didn't. I imagined them, though. I imagined that lots and lots of families went through that struggle. Like, okay, you talk big. This is a great leader, but who's going to buy shoes for the kids come school time? And so, but people just. People saw something in Caesar that allowed them to do things that they, you know, that they would not have done. They saw leadership qualities in Caesar as a human being and as an organizer, as a strategist, that gave them hope that this was not wasted, because
right.
It could easily have been wasted, and that it would turn to something. And then he had the skill, you know, to draw in support, like from us and other church leadership people and other organizations. He had a reach and a vision, you know, to bring in support that would encourage the workers. Like Friday night strike meetings, people from afar would be introduced, and they would say, I'm going back to Berkeley, or I'm going back to L.A., or I'm going back to Chicago, or I'm going back to tell about what's happening here and to get support for you, so that people felt almost from the beginning that they weren't just alone in this rural town that was essentially against them.
Right. Now, what did you see?
That was a quality, you know, that was something about his leadership that brought that into being.
Right. Now, let's talk about his style of leadership. Was he hands-on? Was he dictatorial? Did he delegate responsibility? Could you explain that? How was he? At least in this period of time.
In this period of time, he didn't have. You know, there weren't that many leaders. There were a few who like worked full time on the strike, and Jim Drake being one of them. And then he had strike captains and. So it wasn't a huge, you know, leadership team, but they met, they discussed, you know, they brainstormed together. Caesar had ideas. He was not imposing his ideas. He was just coming up with ideas. He was always just like a little bit ahead of everybody, because he was always thinking about, like, what would work and what should we do and what about tomorrow and what about next year. And he read and he thought, and he just, like, his whole being was kind of, like, focused on this struggle and winning it, so that if you argued with him, he would argue. Sometimes you could win, sometimes you couldn't, but usually he won because he had already thought it through, you know, long before you had. So, he was not a dictatorial style at all. This period, it was more collegial, and his learning, his experience, his brain power being sort of brought to the fore in ways that people recognized, damn, that's right, that might work. There's kind of a dispute about who thought up the first boycott.
Which was the boycott
of Shenley. And I think it was Jim's idea, actually. The best I could find out, it was... Shenley Industries had a great vineyard in Delano. So I'm sure Shenley Industries might not even have known it. Or the people who make decisions didn't know it. So Jim had this idea, well, heck, we've got friends in New York, we have friends in Chicago, we have friends in Washington, D.C., we have friends in L.A., San Francisco. Why don't we just start talking to liquor stores about Shenley products? And you can support the strike in Delano by taking these Shenley products off here. And then after talking to them, let's create a little pressure on them. Let's send delegations to visit them. And so Caesar basically said, Jim, here's this office, which is about the size of a closet, and a phone, and you just go do it. And by Jove, it worked. Because when Shenley realized that their products might be boycotted nationally and internationally over this little grape vineyard, in Delano, they sent an attorney out to Los Angeles to settle it. Not to have an election, but to sign a representation agreement. So that was Cindy Korshak, a famous mob attorney, apparently. And this is one of Caesar and Bill Kircher were going to meet with Cindy Korshak, and Caesar asked me to go along. Because I think he knew that the presence of the church was confusing. To the Sidney Korshaks of the world and even the Bill Kirchers of the world, although we became good friends with Bill Kircher over time. And then eventually with the Teamsters, that they didn't know what to do. They didn't really know how to talk to church people, but they didn't know what to do with them. They didn't know what they represented. So it was partly just like a playfulness. Let's discomfort these people as much as possible. But partly he just wanted another witness, somebody else who could sort of fairly objectively say what he thought had gone on here. But that meeting wasn't necessary. We met in this gorgeous Beverly Hills mansion of Korshak's, and he was cordial and invited us in, and we had conversation, and we talked about interesting things, and then they signed this agreement. That was it. And then Caesar and I drove up to somewhere near Lodi, where the march to Delano, march to Sacramento, was going on at this time. So. They held the evening rally until we got there, and then Caesar could, announce the great victory at Shenley. Wow. And then that night, all the signs were being carried many of the signs being carried in the march were changed from Shenley to DiGiorgio.
Overnight.
Overnight.
So, Chris, I wanted to go off here on this whole idea of the role of religion, the role of the church in the movement. Is that something that you and Caesar discussed and strategized on? How did you guys approach that?
Interesting question. I mean, we discussed it often in the sense of, can we get 14 clergy to Delano, to get arrested, because the sheriff won't yell us, let us say, yeah, well, God, the picket line, right?
Right?
Or can we get delegations here to visit Delano from the national church scene? Or first from the state church scene, and then from the national church scene? And both of us understanding that that the more the world knew about what was going on here, the more difficult it would be for the growers to isolate the union and crush it right there in Delano, which they've always been able to do in the past, which the growers had always been able to do. So in those senses, we discuss it now. I'm trying to remember, did we discuss the value that this had for the workers? Because at some points we must have, because whether we did or we didn't, I knew that having church people visible and supportive and on the picket line and speaking at Friday night strike meetings and being on the march to Sacramento, and that all that religious visibility, Catholic, Protestant, whatever, was an encouragement to the workers.
Right.
And I used to tell our supporters, I mean, you're coming here, I know you're going to feel uncomfortable when you have to leave. You come for 2 or 3 days, and you leave, and you feel like, God, these workers are here, and they're going to be here forever. But believe me, your being here is just a whole lot more powerful than you realize. And your presence here is more supportive of the workers than the church itself actually deserves.
Yeah.
Somehow Jesus comes through, you know, regardless of where our institutions are, and workers feel like this is a good thing we're doing. We believe it's a good thing, but if the church says it's a good thing, this is a good thing. And if people say Caesar's a communist and the church is supporting him, then he can't be a communist. And so it was just more helpful to workers themselves than it first appeared to anybody. Everybody saw it obviously as kind of like a practical, you know, pragmatic support for and visibility and spreading the word, but not thinking about how much it meant to the workers themselves. But Caesar, of course, knew, and I learned.
But you and Caesar,
because most of the workers were, you know, most of the workers came from a very traditional religious background.
Right. But you and Caesar must have been in sync somehow on that whole spiritual element. But although you didn't talk about it, did you get a sense of that and from the very beginning?
Yeah. I mean, we both could see the kind of like the multiple levels of value of the involvement of the church, and I'm sure Caesar saw it ahead of time, because of, you know, of how much he had read and thought and planned, you know, for this day when we would be in this kind of a fight. And for me, it was like just a gradual learning process. One of the obvious things was that the growers were calling Caesar a communist, you know, trained in Cuba. He and Saul Alinsky both trained in Cuba. And here he is, you know, agitating our workers in Delano, our happy, wonderful United Nations array of workers. And but you know, he's got the church there with him. It's kind of hard. It makes it very much harder. Caesar used to say, "Well, they say a lot of things about the Catholic Church, but they don't say they're communists."
Right. Well, some of these growers were Catholics themselves.
How did that all work out?
I mean,
well, at first it was really the Protestant growers who had it the hardest, because we were Protestants, right? And the Catholic Church was just not that visible at first.
Right.
Individual Catholics were, like, wonderful priests and wonderful nuns and wonderful lay people, you know, got involved almost as soon as they knew it was happening. But as an organization, the Migrant Ministry was really the only church organization that was there. And so Protestant growers began discovering, you know, slowly but surely, that their own local church, where their kids go to Sunday school and where they maybe have helped build the building or build it, the whole thing themselves, right, is supporting these maniacs, you know, these crazy young ministers. So then every local church in every agricultural valley in California kind of like went on record asking their denomination to withdraw whatever support there might be for the migrant ministry in their denomination. So that created this like 2-3 year firestorm of political struggle within the churches, all separate from the struggle in the fields. Separate, but not separate.
Separate, but not separate. What do you mean?
Well, we had to fight these fights in every single Protestant denomination, and some of them have 2 or 3 called, you know, like judicatories, like dioceses and presbyteries and synods, etc. So, like, you had to fight it in Northern California, you had to fight it in Southern California, you had to fight it in Central California, which, of course, we weren't going to win that one. But and in the process of fighting these fights, of course, our friends would come to our aid, and we would win more friends. And the discussion around whether to support the migrant ministry always led to the question of whether farm workers needed a union, whether justice for farm workers was something the church ought to be supporting. So it was like this huge battle, but also this huge educational project going on at the same time. So what was going on in Delano and was definitely related to the struggle we were having in the church, which we basically won because in almost all the denominations there were more urban churches and therefore more urban delegates than there were rural churches and rural delegates. And on top of the fact that the urban churches were probably bigger and had more delegates per church. So except for the San Joaquin Diocese of the Episcopal Church, which just withdrew from the National Episcopal Church, as you may have read, right, over entirely other issues, we won every single denominational fight, and mainly because we had good friends and strong arguments and the right cause.
Well, looking back, I mean, here we are. You know, years have gone by, and Caesar's been dead for 15 years. What do you think that his legacy is with respect to the churches, not only the Catholic Church but all the Protestant Church and all the supporters? I mean, did he leave his mark? Did he make a difference in how we see the, you know, what Christianity or you know, the roles of churches are to in regard to, you know, poor people, to workers, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. It was particularly for the Protestant churches, because for the Catholic Church, supporting labor unions was kind of like old hat. But for Protestant churches, who are mostly, you know, dominated by management and middle management and lower management, who are, you know, dominated more by white-collar people than blue-collar people, this was like a whole new event. And so Caesar's leadership, the sacrifices of the farm workers, drew the Protestant churches into a labor struggle in a way they had not been, I don't know, ever before. And in drawing them in, they inevitably learned all these things, you know, about labor law and boycotts and secondary boycotts and, you know, how you put pressure on supermarkets and how that pressure actually works. And the reason that they got so involved is partly because of us, you know, in California. But it was more because all those workers went out to these cities across the country from Delano in 1967, 68, to be boycott coordinators. It's crazy when you think of it. Most of them couldn't speak any decent English. Probably all of them had never been outside of the San Joaquin Valley before in their lives. And so here they are in, you know, Indianapolis and Chicago and Boston and New York and, you know, with the task of stopping the grapes in their city. And all they've got is the name of maybe a potential priest, a potential minister, a potential labor leader. And then their job is to build a coalition of supporters. But I used to say, you know, here's this family that's come from Delano, into this cold weather without good English and explaining their battle and asking for your help, how could you say no? I mean, how could anybody say no? And what happened was that church people heard their story and they got involved, and then if they needed resources on what was happening, they asked us and we'd send them resources. And so they got so involved with those workers that they would do anything. You want me to sit in at a grape counter? Yeah. You want me to organize a prayer service at a grape counter? Yeah.
Yeah.
You want me to fill carts with food with the grapes on the bottom and leave them in the store? Yeah. So, like leafleting in front of the store, that was sort of like step one. and then people just fell in love with this part of their lives. And when the boycott closed down, there was like anguish all over the country. Like, what are we going to do with our lives now that the boycotters are gone? So it had a huge impact, and it was really the Caesar's example to start with, and then the example of all these plain folks, you know, who are doing the impossible and learning English and learning how to organize and learning how to speak in public. And anyway, it was just a hugely powerful thing. And then this local minister gets involved, or his local layperson gets involved, and then they want their local church to do something, and then they care so much, they want their synod to do something, and then they want their national church to do something, and it becomes personal with them because of their connection to these folks. So anyway, it was a powerful thing, and as I say, and so people learn so much about labor because of it.
But it seems like this, you know, this whole concept of empowerment, among these people who had, you know, very limited resources, all the way to the folks who were, you know, in the churches assisting with the boycott. This whole idea of empowerment is a wonderful idea. Where did that come from? Did that come from Caesar?
That came from the CSO years. I mean, that's what you saw on CSO. You saw poor people, just, you know, plain folks who are poor, organizing and getting things done in their local communities, just by being organized and just by pushing in the right place at the right time, and by registering to vote, and by, you know, exerting their influence as citizens. And all these CSO chapters had just like one little victory after another little victory, and then bigger victories, and they would report them to each other at conventions, and it was just like it was a beautiful thing to see even before the strike. And I was on a Delano picket line one time, and it was just like these big people, the picketers on the sideline, men and women. Women were the best in terms of humiliating men who are still working in the field, and with armed guards, you know, guarding the workers, and foremen checking on what their workers were doing, what they weren't doing. And of course, just the picket line itself distracted the speed and quality of the work. But then this little old guy somewhere in the middle of the field stood up, and he just, you know, he couldn't do it anymore. He couldn't stay there. He just walked out to the edge of the field. And he, you know, walked past his supervisor, and he walked past the armed guard, and he just came into the arms of all these strikers. And I said, just watching that guy do that, and the look in his face, and the feeling of, you know, the pride that you could see. I mean, one of those events, I saw many of them, but one of those events was enough to keep me going for weeks and months. And that's what happened to our friends out in the cities. They saw these workers and these families, you know, doing what they were doing, you know, coming so far and make such a sacrifice, and they just got drawn in. So it was Caesar's example, you know, of hard work and sacrifice that got the workers, and then it was the workers' hard work and sacrifice that got all these millions of supporters.
Wow. Now, one of the things is that Caesar you know, was a person who was willing to do whatever, you know, he wasn't going to go ask somebody to do something he wasn't willing to do himself. Is that correct? Is that a correct assumption?
Yes. Yes.
How, you know, when people saw that, what was the reaction? What did it move them? Did it reinforce their commitment?
It just reinforced for them their belief in his leadership. And when you think about it, you know, just how important that was. I mean, they were putting their jobs on their line, and in some cases, leaving their families to go, you know, across the country to strange cities. I mean, if you didn't have some, you know, deep belief in your leadership, you just could not do that. I mean, if the leadership felt like they were said one thing and did another, or they were, you know, on one agenda one day and another agenda another day, if they were flaky in any way, it was just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure this is worth it.
Yeah.
I'm going to wait till I see somebody a little more substantive come along. But Caesar had that substance from day one. And people thought, they felt it, they believed in him, and then they were willing to do these amazing things that, and of course, you know, here we were, in many ways, working our tails off, right, to support, but always feeling like the workers were, like, ahead of us in terms of their willingness to give and to sacrifice, and so it was always a challenge to us to do more. And that just kept being true.
Now, over the years, and you were with Caesar for many years, I believe 28 years. I mean, what changes did you see in terms of Caesar's leadership and his ability to really kind of read, you know, where the direction where the union and the movement should be going? What changes did you see?
Well, first, let me go back a minute, okay?
Yeah.
You said legacy.
Yeah.
I think what for all of us in the religious community, Catholic, Protestant, whatever.
Right.
It was the impact of, it was learning the power of sacrifice.
Right.
Which we should have known, right? From our Bibles, but it's theology is one thing and life is another. and through Caesar and the farm workers movement, we discovered, you know, in our hearts, the power of sacrifice and what it can do in empowering people themselves, but also in empowering others to follow. And you know, just again and again and again, the march, the fasts, it was just a crucial part of the whole movement. But anyway, back to you. Actual question. My own observation, you know, after all these years and thinking back, is that the passage of the Agricultural Labor Relations Act in 1975, which everybody was in favor of and fought hard for, and it's, you know, as labor laws goes, it's a great law. And it's even been improved somewhat since, but I think for Caesar himself, there was a turning of a corner. I mean, it led to a period in which Caesar was kind of like struggling to, you know, to find his place of leadership. Because what he knew about was organizing and fighting and responding to the other side and finding a new strategy if it didn't work, and always pushing and trying to figure out how to put pressure on the growers and to do it as creatively and nonviolently as possible and to bring other people from all over the country into it. I mean, that's where his gift was. Now we have this law, you know, with all these rules and regulations and lawyers and state boards, agriculture labor relations boards, and politicians involved, and it just, it made the battle just more complicated. And I think there were periods after 1975, but then 76. There was just implementing the law. There was just a big two-year battle to get it done right and get the Teamsters out of the fields. But after that period was over, say 75, 76, 77, I think Caesar was then kind of like searching for what next. And I think it was hard for him. And it showed.
Yeah. Well, there was a period there when the union stopped organizing, and they were and the union was trying other things.
Caesar began to emphasize, community life at La Paz, and playing the sit-and-on game so we could get more honest with each other, and reading the famous management guy from Claremont. Peter Drucker, reading together his big management book and implementing management tools, but they were all things that kind of like came and went, and there was just like this, we lost some of that kind of like sustaining drive toward, some victory and struggle.
Right. Now, were you concerned at this point? Did you say, "Uh-oh, we've lost our way, and what do we do now?"
No, absolutely not. I mean, I believed in the whole idea of community life. I played the sit-and-on game. I moved to La Paz in 1981 because what happened to me was, with the passage of the law, I sensed immediately Church's support for the boycott was just not going to be, it was not going to be life and death anymore. Because the boycott was not going to be life and death anymore. What was going to be life and death was winning elections and negotiating contracts. And then, so that boycotts would happen, but they would be kind of like sporadic and short, and boycotters were brought home to, to organize in the fields, and so it was like I could sense that the role of the migrant ministry, which had now become the National Farm Worker Ministry, was just going to be different. It wasn't going to be as crucial.
Right.
So I began to lose my own, energy for my role as director of the National Farm Worker Ministry. So in 81, I resigned and left, and my wife and I moved up to the Farm Workers Headquarters, and I just worked as a department head within the union, and some really important people left, and Caesar worried too much about people who were like trying to sabotage us from within, but I think all that reflected this fact that he was an organizer and a fighter, and that this new regime of the law was not his cup of tea.
Right.
Some people have said, God, I wish Caesar had just left the administration of the union to somebody else and gone to Texas and done the same thing, or to Florida, and done what he did. But he couldn't, I guess he couldn't just leave it go. It was too much his baby.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that if he had... was it a problem of delegating, or was it a problem? What was the problem there in that he wasn't as political?
It was probably multiple. It was probably that it was probably like at the gut level, sort of like, this is my baby, how can I trust it to anybody else? And it was partly like, who could I actually trust?
Right.
Because trust was not easy thing for Caesar. And would I get to Texas and then, find out that, that I had to come back to California because this person who I trusted is, like, screwing things up, or, starting to pay salaries to people instead of, room and board and $10 a week, anyway. So it was a multiple thing. And to what extent he actually had this kind of, like, conscious thought in his own mind, like, maybe this is the time when I should go, I don't know. I know he had in his mind the whole his dream of a communal farm for farm workers, like a farmland land that the union owned or that the service center owned, one of the entities of the union owned, right? And it was a farm worker run as part of an intentional community, and more like a kibbutz than most things you would see.
Right.
In this country, and he, he just, that was like, we would talk about that for long periods of time, and it was almost like it was a dream, but it was also recreation for him. It was something to take his mind off the other difficult things that were going on at this period in the, after the 77, 78. So, but it was, he definitely believed in, and he believed at this period that our strength would be in our ability to be a community, but actually, it was getting harder and harder to do that. The work was being like dispersed to many different, tasks and expertises, or whatever the word is.
Good.
So you had to train negotiators, and you had to have people who knew how to win elections, and then you had to have people who could do quick, boycotts when somebody didn't want to negotiate a contract. And you had the lawyers in Sacramento making sure that the law was being, followed. And so we were like, we were no longer this, like, unified campaign.
Right.
To win the grape boycott or the lettuce boycott or the gala boycott or whatever.
Right.
Now, it was like a difficult, difficult time.
Yeah. But you decided to move up to La Paz from 1981 to late 80, 80, I believe.
89.
To 89. And what changes did you see there with the union, but also particularly with Caesar? What was going on there? What else? What else did you notice?
What I noticed was that we... We would like latch on to something very important, but not stay with it. That there was a kind of a jumping around of focus, which was a new thing. Focus had always been our, one of our keys to success. And so that, that was troubling, but it's actually more troubling, in retrospect.
Right.
When you're part of it, you're just, any doubts you have, you kind of like rationalize them. And if people leave who you wish hadn't left, and if they're leaving because they've been pushed out, you kind of try to see Caesar's side of it and not see whether the justice or the injustice of it.
Right.
So, but later on, you could look back and see that it was a troubling time. It was just not as focused as it was. And then we got involved in the pesticide campaign and the Great Boycott, which was focused on pesticides, which was being run really by direct mail and by distributing a video all over the country, and not by actual boycotters, working in cities to organize this boycott. So it didn't have that same personal power, that the first boycotts had. And
but were you aware that this was not working at that time, or is this I'm looking back now? What was the kind
it
of
always,
tenor?
It always had a kind of a, if someone had pressed me at the time, I would have said, our supporters are going to know that this is really not about pesticides. This is using pesticides to get contracts, because that's what we want. We want a union. We want a union so we can negotiate pesticides out of the fields through contracts. that's what workers need, and that's what we all know. Because, you know, growers can agree to stop using pesticides 1 year and use the next if there's not a contract.
Right.
So, and I always had an instinctual feeling that our supporters would figure out that the pesticides was, even though it was what we were, it was our message, it was actually secondary to what our goal was. And that, in that sense, it lacked some of the integrity of the earlier boycotts. And then Caesar fasted on this because of the suffering of families due to pesticides in 1988. And it was his longest fast of all, and with a dramatic, you know, conclusion with Mrs. Kennedy and Jesse Jackson and thousands of people in Delano, and then the growers didn't call. Nothing happened. And then everybody think, oh, geez, what do you do next year? Right. I mean, instead of 33 days, the Caesar's fast for 50 days next year. I'm sure that fast shortened his life, too.
Right.
But anyway, so there was and maybe it couldn't. I mean, maybe it was one of these, that the law brought a transition that made the same kind of focused fights we'd had before impossible.
Right.
But it also meant that this new kind of fight was harder for us and harder for him, and that administrative things were harder for him.
Now, did anybody raise a flag at that point and try to tell Caesar you were going in the wrong direction? And
there was dispute, not around earlier in the, there was a strike in Imperial Valley and in Salinas in 1980-81, and then there was a Bruce Church boycott to support that strike. And there was an argument about who should go out on the Bruce Church boycott and who should stay and organize in the fields. And that became a real important struggle between some key leaders and Caesar. And then there was a struggle about paying salaries. Like, how will we ever get farm workers as organizers? If we're inviting them and their families to earn less than they make as farm workers under contract. And so that battle went on, and Caesar just held firm to this conviction that we could not get into a salaried union position, which would lead to kind of like bureaucracy and apathy and 9-to-5 jobs and all that, all that kind of like business unionism had become. So that was a critical, divisive internal struggle in the late 70s, which he won, but he won it really by saying, you're going to have to, if you do this, you're going to have to do it without me. I cannot do it if we pay salaries. And so some people just wisely decided that was the wrong way to go and then left.
Right. Now,
some of the people who left were, some of our best.
Yeah. But you stayed around for many, many years.
I did.
When you left, was that a difficult thing for you?
Yeah, and I... it was a good thing for me to leave. It was an extremely difficult. But as when all those things happen in your life, as it turned out, it was a very good thing for my wife and I and our kids.
Yeah. Well, you've been doing it for 28 years, I guess. Any major change like that would have.
Oh, wow.
So, Chris, I thank you so much for sharing these wonderful stories. What have we missed here? What are things that we should try to know any other stories you have about Caesar?
Well,
and his legacy and something, some insight into who this person was. and how it may
have one story. One story has to do with sort of like the unions and Caesar's legacy in the church was in 1973. That was when the Teamsters, you know, raided the contracts. And a big strike in Coachella, which then spread up the Strait. It was, you know, grape workers protesting the Teamster takeover of the contracts.
Right.
And the growers just made a deal, right? They just made a backroom deal with the Teamsters, and that was it. So there's a huge strike going on, and Teamsters goons on the line, and Teamster goons following picket captains home and dragging them out of their cars and beating them up, and anyway... Just, you know, lots of fear, lots of intimidation, lots of... So the United Church of Christ, one of our best denominational supporter, was meeting in their national synod in St. Louis, and our friends in the United Church of Christ said, well, what can we do? They said, some people are talking about, like, sending a delegation out to Coachella, and I said, that's great, do it. So before we know it, they're talking about a plane load of delegates from the synod, two from each of their state conferences, right, and to come to sort of like observe. Funny thought, but anyway, some of them coming to support, some of them coming to, some of them like small farmers, farm bureau members. So, in the middle of all the deliberations, John Moyer, my contact guy, says, "Chris, this is going to cost us a lot of money. I mean, wouldn't Caesars just rather have this money?" And I didn't even ask him. I said, no way. Caesar wants to send the people. And, of course, that was what he wanted. And so these 95 people came out by plane, by charter plane, landing in Ontario, busing to Coachella, arriving at 5 o'clock in the morning, and all the strikers have, you know, gathered in a park in Coachella. And they get off the bus, and they just, people are crying and hugging and singing and clapping and just like embracing them. And I told them they had sort of like 30 seconds of objective observation before they were swept up in the in La Causa.
And they were never the same again.
And that we just had the United Church of Christ National Synod just celebrated the 30th anniversary of that event.
Wow.
In Minneapolis. And the Coachella 95, as they were called, remained, you know, it's like an organized group within the denomination. And some of them are dead now, but many of them are still alive, and I'm sure they don't. That's one of the things they will remember most about their lives.
Yeah. How wonderful!
So, at that time, that was the strike that brought the Catholic Church in full force. 1973.
Right.
The bishops had been, you know, instrumental in negotiating the first contracts in 70, but then they came in full force and, you know, in visible support of the strike and the boycott.
Right.
Caesar said to me, he said, "Chris, the growers can have the Teamsters. I'll take the Catholic Church."
Well, Chris, I just wanted to thank you so much for, you know, for being so, you know, forthright and so, you know, so honest about your observations. And it's one other question for you, in terms of, you know, you and Caesar, you as individuals, what did you see each other as, you know, best friends, as, you know, soulmates, or was it there was it more was it less personal? Was it more of an arm's length relationship, a business relationship that the two of you had?
It was. We were not best friends.
Okay.
We were close collaborators, right? And he would share things with me that he couldn't share with others, because for most of the time I was outside the union, right? I was a director of a parallel organization. So we were close, and he shared a lot of things, but we were not... Caesar had family, and he had... supporters, and then he had close working partners. But friends, I don't know if he had friends. But it was hard for him to have friends, because his people then left. When you left the union, you were like sort of, you walked across this invisible dividing line from being significant human being to being not a significant human being. Your significance for Caesar was in your role as part of the movement. And when you were outside that role, you were a good memory, or not a good memory, depending. But you were no longer, like a significant person.
And was that
friends,
difficult for you?
No, not friends. And people who claim that they were friends with Caesar, I'm doubtful.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're leaving, that separation when you're in, with the group and you're no longer with the organization, that must have been tough not only for you but for others.
Say that again?
No.
Was that a question or a comment?
I imagine, though, I'm just wondering, based on what you observed, that was difficult for you to be in and then not in. Did you see that in others?
Yeah, my leaving, you mean?
Yes.
My leaving was difficult for me, but also for others, definitely for others. Most people believed in Lekausa, right? Whether they were outside or not, whether they were, whether it disturbed them that I had left or anything, they would come down to, it's about the farm workers, so we're going to support the farm workers.
Yeah, whether you're there or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so there was that was With Caesar, was that some kind of was that his nature? Was it a personality trait, or was it his way of dealing with life? That you leave, so then I cut you off. I mean, what's the
I think it's a. I think it just comes with his being the organizer that he was. That everything. Everything that mattered was focused on this task in front of us. And if you're part of, getting us to that final, to that end or that victory or that completion, then wonderful. If you're not, you're fine, but you're just not.
Right.
You're just not in that same category. You're in a different club.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I think we're gonna wrap it up.
Yeah, I think it's time.
I think we've got some great stories. I think we've got some wonderful material for for the Who Was Cesar Chavez segment for Leroy. And so I just want to thank you so much. And Jim, thank you so much for recording. And Chris, it was wonderful talking to you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.